I want to welcome everybody to this Middle East Forum event. My name is Scott Rosenblum, and I'm a member of the board of the forum and a partner of Cramer Levin, host of today's briefing by Gerald Steinberg. You're welcome. First, a few words about the Middle East Forum. The forum's mission is to define and promote American interests in the Middle East and help the United States defend itself against Islamist threats. The forum accomplishes its mission intellectually by providing context, insights, and policy recommendations through its publications, operationally by exerting an active influence on the course of events through its projects, philanthropically by distributing $2 million earmarked funds annually, helping researchers, writers, investigators, and activists around the world. Specifically, some of the forum's activities include the Washington Project, which monitors and influences U.S. policy in the Middle East, the Legal Project, which protects free speech about Islam and related topics, and protects writers and researchers from frivolous lawsuits and intimidation, the Campus Watch, which monitors extremism and bias in Middle East studies, Islamist Watch, which monitors nonviolent Islamist activities, and the Middle East Quarterly, a policy-oriented journal which provides cutting-edge information on the Middle East. The forum's websites have received millions of visits, and I invite you to visit our website, meforum.org, for further information about the forum's activities. I also hope you consider supporting the forum financially. As a not-for-profit organization with a staff of 19 and a budget exceeding $1.5 million, the forum relies on its tax-deductible contributions, which support a well-managed and lean, but highly productive and effective organization. Your contributions will be put to excellent use. As we begin, please switch off all cell phones and pagers. We ask that you hold comments and questions until after the formal presentation ends. And now it is my pleasure to introduce to you our speaker, Gerald Steinberg. Gerald Steinberg was former chair of the Political Studies Department at Bar-Ilan University, where he currently teaches. He was also a consultant to the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs, participates in the Inter-Parliamentary Coalition for Combating Anti-Semitism, and is a member of the Academic Advisory Board of the Israel Law Review. In 2002, he founded NGO Monitor, of which he is president, to promote accountability and advance a vigorous discussion on the reports and activities of NGOs which claim to promote moral agendas such as humanitarian aid and human rights. His op-ed columns appear in the Jerusalem Post, Wall Street Journal Europe, Financial Times, National Review Online, International Herald Tribune, and other publications. And he's a frequent commentator on CBC, NPR, the BBC, as well as others. Today, Mr. Steinberg will discuss the recent wave of attempts to demonize and isolate Israel and offer ideas on ways to counter this campaign. Please welcome Gerald Steinberg.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming out. I was going to start by thanking Daniel Pipes, but Daniel and I are playing the skies balance, so he's off in Israel and Jerusalem actually speaking, and I'm here. But I do want to thank the Middle East Forum, which I've been associated with in different ways for, I think, more years than I care to count. And I think that a lot of the work that we do is very, very much in common. I always think of NGO Monitor as filling a need that wasn't recognized, and I'll explain to you why it wasn't recognized and why this need needs to be filled. We're all dealing with the same major war, the war of the 21st century, in different ways. And those issues need to be dealt with. In fact, before I talk about Israel, I want to talk about the broader issue of the way in which human rights and moral values, moral principles, international law, humanitarian aid have become very cynically exploited for what I guess is best stated as the opposite of what they are intended for. Most of what we use now in terms of the language of human rights, in terms of what's called dealing with warfare, asymmetric warfare, war crimes, international law, law of armed conflict, this is, we're in a law office, right? So if the lawyers here, these are all international law. This has become a very dominant part of the language of that process, was developed very much in the shadow of the Holocaust. And like the United Nations, I'm hesitant to use the word naive, so I will say idealistic. These were very idealistic projects, concepts, when with the complete shock of what happened in the Holocaust, the complete anger at the way in which human beings had so been degraded, that there had to be something different that was set up. And in the context of the United Nations in 1948, the United Nations adopted a universal, and each word is important, Universal Declaration of Human Rights. That's what the UDHR, Universal Declaration of Human Rights, in 1948. Also a genocide, a convention that banned genocide, and eventually most of the countries of the world signed on to that framework. And it created a very broad infrastructure. The United Nations, first the Commission on Human Rights was set up, and then the United Nations Human Rights Council, and later on the International Criminal Court was created, and a whole group of non-governmental organizations which were developed under the auspices of these frameworks to promote these very values. The what was later became Human Rights Watch, originally Helsinki Watch, was developed by a gentleman named Robert Bernstein, who came back from having, as chairman of Random House, CEO of Random House, negotiating agreements and having met Sakharov and become acquainted later on with Sharansky's story, decided that this was something that he could not sit by while these people were being having their human rights violated. And he created Helsinki Watch, became Human Rights Watch. And around the same time, or a little bit earlier, Amnesty International was created to go out and defend prisoners of conscience in closed societies. Now we're in a completely different situation. We are 30 years, 35 years after those organizations were created, and these very frameworks have become very much the enemies of human rights. They have become, they've created a whole, what I call, parallel universe, in which the human rights violators are the United States and Israel and NATO and democracies. And Human Rights Watch was talking 2 years ago about how the Gaddafi family was instituting reforms, and the Gaddafi Foundation was creating what they called the Tripoli Spring. That this was like the Prague Spring. They were raising money in Saudi Arabia not to help women. Human rights, even to drive in Saudi Arabia. That wasn't, they went to human rights explicitly in order to raise funds so that they could fight what they called the pro-Israel lobby. That was me. That was at the time of the Gaza war, and afterwards to support the Goldstone accusations, the notorious Goldstone report. Human Rights Council, well, I went to a Human Rights Council meeting in 2009, just before the Durban 2 conference. It was chaired by the representative from this great human rights bastion, Libya. And the Iran and Cuba and all of their friends were voting for one issue, and that's the Article 7 of Condemn Israel. And I could just talk about this in general, but what I'm saying is that this is a big, broad issue. And I'll go a little bit further, and I don't want to talk, I'll talk about the Israel-specific issues, but this is not only about Israel. One of the reasons the United States has not been able to sustain its position in Afghanistan or Iraq is because every time that there's a claim of a civilian being killed, it immediately stops the entire process. Now, nobody's in favor of killing civilians, but the allegations of deliberate attacks against civilians, or disproportionality, or violation of international law, all of these terms that are thrown around very loosely, and again, primarily against democratic societies, except if the big issue, well, I won't go into the exceptions right now, I'll talk about that later. These forced, we had an incident where, there are a series of incidents, where either real or manufactured claims that in trying to prevent killing of civilians by Taliban or by Al-Qaeda in Iraq. There are allegations that civilians were killed, and immediately the entire process of self-defense against terror comes to a halt. And this happens over and over again. And this has become very much part of modern warfare. And I would even argue that it's become the main principle of modern what's called asymmetric warfare. If you can be perceived, if you can claim victimhood, if you can say that the other side is killing civilians indiscriminately, unjustifiably, or just plain killing civilians, whether it's true or not. And let's remember that most of the accusations against Israel have been proven to be false in Gaza and Lebanon and other places, and I'll give you specific examples, or in Jenin. Then immediately, if you're a Western democratic society, you are unable to defend your interests. This abuse of the language of human rights has permeated modern international relations, the relation between states, and that's really what this is all about. And until NGO One, until I realized how absolutely powerful these organizations were, there's nobody watching the watchers. You've got organizations like Human Rights Watch, which is, I think, headquartered not far from here. It's got a budget of around 50 million plus. Soros just offered to provide another 10 million. We're not quite sure in how many years. That's almost an infinite budget. And Amnesty has a huge budget. And you have dozens of these organizations in Europe and elsewhere. There is no other example I can think of in Western society where they have so much power and so little accountability, so little transparency, so little analysis. And the abuse is so great, and that's what led me to begin to look at this, to move from, as Nina always reminds me, from my days of being a quiet physicist, or not such a quiet physicist, looking at all sorts of other issues and saying, this is something that has to be addressed. It's like a huge imbalance in the world of nature where something has to be corrected. And I decided that was what was necessary to be done. Now, this is the United, I talked about briefly about the Human Rights Council. The majority of the countries on the Human Rights Council, the bastion of human rights, the majority are either countries from the Organization of the Islamic Conference or their allies. Two-thirds of the countries are not in any way democratic. And I listed some of the names. Because they control, because the OIC, the Organization of Islamic Conference, has so many votes, and it's able to distribute in such a way they've concentrated their ability to influence the UN in the UN Human Rights Council, which means that the only country they've talked about on a regular basis is Israel. It's a permanent agenda item. And the last couple of years, 27 out of 33 resolutions focused on Israel. I won't go through all the details. That's not the primary purpose of my talk. But what I am saying is that the institutions have been completely corrupted. I saw this trigger that got me into this and to realize that there needs to be some sort of accountability, some sort of a process, which became NGO Monitor, was the Durban Conference of 2001, where there was an NGO forum that was attended by 1,500 organizations, including the organizations I just mentioned, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty, and many others, under the banner of human rights, under the sponsorship of the UN, in those days, Commission for Human Rights, it was chaired by Mary Robinson, and 1,500 NGOs participated, and they adopted what we all know now, what we recognize now as the language of BDS, of Israel Apartheid. This is, for those of you who missed it, this is one of three Israel Apartheid weeks. It's Israel Apartheid Week lasts a month now. And this is I think we're in the second week now on some campuses. And if you look at the language that was adopted by the NGO forum of the 2001 Durban Conference, this is the blueprint for what we call the BDS sewer system that you have in front of you. This is the blueprint for how are we going to wage war against Israel politically. We're going to repeatedly use the words racist apartheid. This is not a policy of opposing specific, this is not about opposing specific policy. Sometimes you'll hear it said that this is only about opposing settlements, and many Israelis are opposed to settlements and the occupation. If you read the language, these organizations are not opposed to Israeli policy. They're opposed to Israel. And they make it very clear. Ali Abu Mina, Electronic Intifada, one of the main speakers at every Israel Apartheid Week event, Omar Barghouti, the perennial PhD student at Tel Aviv University, who runs the Palestinian, what's it called, the PACB, the Palestinian, whatever it is, for boycotts of Israel, the Palestinian Committee for the Boycott of Israel, to make it very clear their goal is the elimination of the Jewish state. And the language that was adopted by these NGOs at Durban repeats the word racist, apartheid, and the bottom line is calls upon the international community to impose a policy of complete and total isolation of Israel as an apartheid state. That's the goal. Not to change Israeli policies. And that's what they've been doing for 8 or 9 years. And before somebody asks me a question, I will already say the Israeli government had no clue. They were asleep at the wheel. They didn't take it seriously. They didn't even see it at all until a year or two afterwards. A year or two ago. Still got the jet lag. The NGOs, I argue, these organizations that wear a halo around their head, that are largely immune from criticism, or they were at least until we got into the business and then it began to develop further, very often are the engines. They are the ones who will use the language of human rights. They will issue a report. They will be seen as authoritative. They'll be quoted on NPR and CBC and in the New York Times and across the board. And you won't be amazed, though I was amazed when I first saw it, how automatically the media picks up these reports without asking any questions. And then, after the media puts it on as a headline story, then it gets debated at the UN through the same process I talked about, and diplomats will then issue condemnations, and it happens repeatedly, and I can give you 25 examples in the last 10 years. And then, of course, it gets quoted in the books by my academic colleagues. Richard Goldstone is perhaps the culmination of this process, finding a South African Jewish judge to put his name on a report that was largely written by these NGOs, which condemns Israel in 500 pages with allegations of war crimes and recommends that action be taken against Israel, because Israel cannot act like a grown-up. Israel doesn't have a functioning military corps or court system for dealing with war crimes, they say. And every boycott, divestment, and sanction, BDS, or Israel Apartheid Week rally, waves the Goldstone Report as proof. I've been to the Goldstone Report. It's just a cut and paste of all the NGO claims, almost none of which had any kind of serious investigation. Palestinian eyewitness testimony. So the process is very well ingrained. The lawfare cases, the cases against Israeli officials, across the board. The head of the opposition, Tzipi Livni, she goes to London, there will be a picture of her being questioned by Scotland Yard because these NGOs were able to find a series of judges and magistrates and law enforcement officials who for different reasons have an axe to grind against Israel and therefore are willing to sign a piece of paper that says, yes, this person is being investigated for war crimes. There are about 100 Israeli officials now who are essentially on a no-fly list going to many European countries, Britain, sometimes Spain, sometimes Holland, and other places. And by the way, that also includes American officials. George W. Bush canceled the trip to Switzerland because a group like this wanted to take out an arrest warrant against him for war crimes in Iraq, and he canceled a trip to Switzerland. This process is funded, it's being conducted by these NGOs. It's funded, and I'll talk about funding in a minute, because this is a huge machine. We're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars and euros and pounds a year. And this was taken from an Al Jazeera program, an Al Jazeera live conference in Cairo, the title of which is, you might be able to see, The Immunity and Prosecution of Israeli War Criminals. And there they thank the European Union, and they thank Oxfam Novib, which is a Dutch humanitarian organization funded by the government. They thank them for sponsoring this conference, under which they were able to organize and say, all right, you take Spain, we'll take Britain, you take Holland, we'll take this country, you'll take that country, and develop this whole process of war, of lawfare, including the ongoing effort in the International Criminal Court in The Hague, bringing charges against Israelis on the grounds of war crimes. Now, none of these cases have ever gone to stage two. The few that have started have been dismissed. There is no case here, at least not in this round. But that's not the point. The point is to get the word Israel and war crimes in the picture in the papers. And they're very good at that. That's what this is all about. It's part of exactly what the Durban declaration was stated very clearly, the complete international isolation of Israel. Last year, the British government suspended five technology, what's called dual-use technology licenses, because Amnesty International and other NGOs went to Parliament and said Israel is violating the terms under which they acquire weapons and technology from Britain. And the British government took it seriously, and they canceled the five licenses for technology. They're not major issues. Israel can buy the parts elsewhere, but it's the beginning of a process, and it's being led by these NGOs, again, without any adult supervision. There's no questions asked. Amnesty says this is a war crime. Amnesty says Israel is using parts for this illegal or that illegal activity, and it becomes part of the process. This is a very, very widely ranging process. And it extends to classical anti-Semitism. These kinds of caricatures are part of the process. It's demonization, and it's very dominant. The United States is relatively, I don't want to use the term mild, but I'll say that in Europe, it's really a insidious viral disease. It has become deeply ingrained, and the link between being an Israel hater and being a classical anti-Semite has just about been erased. Anthony Julius, the well-known lawyer, has written a book tracing the history of British anti-Semitism. The last three chapters deal with modern anti-Semitism, meaning Israel phobia and hatred of Israel, and the way it's morphed through these types of images from these organizations, all of which are funded by European governments. So we see, for instance, the Badil, which is what's called the Right of Return organization, is funded by about a half a dozen European countries, something called the NDC, which is a four-country consortium, the Danish humanitarian aid organization in Norway, all of which are and quote-unquote aid organizations, and this is what their aid does. It's this kind of propaganda, classical anti-Semitic stereotypes. When we brought this to the attention of the funding governments, they took down, the organization took down the image from its website. So you can tell that the governments, had they been doing their job and monitoring how their money's used, they never would have gone up on the website, and they never would have had this type of I've got it here. If I start to choke, then they'll tell me to have a drink. Now, one of the other issues, apart from the bias and the anti-Semitism, is the degree to which these organizations are relied upon as arbiters of international law in war situations. You have to remember, I have to remember too, these organizations, human rights, I said, was founded, the modern concept of human rights, on the basis of the Holocaust. It had nothing to do with the type of warfare that we see in Afghanistan or Iraq or terrorism or Sri Lanka or Israel and Gaza or Lebanon. But at the end of the Cold War, these organizations had to find another purpose, another raison d'etre. They were superpowers. They had large budgets and large staffs, and the heads got like Ken Roth and like Irene Khan from the... at that time from Amnesty, and others got to be on primetime television and invited to Davos and to the White House. They weren't going to say, okay, mission accomplished, we're going to go home. So what they did is they found an issue which was readily accessible. It was in the news a lot. It was associated with a lot of emotions and money. I don't know whether they first gravitated to being anti-Israel or first gravitated to what's called asymmetric warfare or countering terrorism. This was before 9/11. But they became all of a sudden experts in how you fight a war. Now, none of these people have even been near a war zone. Their claims are completely, and we've analyzed dozens of them, largely bogus, both when they use international law terms and when they make claims about military capabilities. But they're accepted as watchdogs, as highly regarded. Amnesty got a Nobel Prize for Peace. And 90% of their activities, their claims, and I said I've been through hundreds of them, NGO monitor staff, who spend, I see, get emails at 4 o'clock in the morning when I'm traveling, they're poring over documents. Time after time, the claims are completely unsourced, unverifiable. There's no context. Israel attacked Gaza, 12 civilians were killed, they used drones, that's a war crime. Now each one of those aspects is wrong, or at best or worst, is unprovable. But these NGOs have acquired this status. They really are the high priests of the religion of the 21st century, of human rights. And they're largely unquestioned. And we see it time after time. And focusing on Israel, because of what I talked about earlier, is a very natural approach. Now, I'm not going to go through this table, just this is my current academic work. This is a list of 12, I don't know, the 12 incidents here, whatever number of rows we have here. We took the Lebanon War as a case study. And we divided it up into four aspects, four dimensions. And that means that we've got 48 different data boxes. And about 40 of them are demonstrably false. Some of you may remember, I'll just take the first one, Kana. On August 1st, I think it was, of 2006, the news headline news story was, Israel deliberately and indiscriminately killed dozens of women and children in an apartment building in Kana in an air attack in the middle of the Lebanon War. And a few hours later, the prime minister got on television and radio and announced that they were going to have a 48-hour air ceasefire. The course of the war changed because of these headlines. And it was, 2 weeks later, I was in Japan. And the headlines in the Japanese papers were still quoting Human Rights Watch. And it turned out that every element of that story was false. And it turned out, 6 months later, Human Rights Watch issued a statement that the numbers turned out. They didn't apologize. They didn't say we were given bad. They said there weren't really dozens of people killed. There were 28, and some of them may have been Hezbollah fighters. And they didn't say we really don't know, but they had no clue. But they were sold a story, or they invented a story that changed, and who knows how many more people were killed and how much longer the Lebanon War went on as a result of this false claim. And I can give you many other examples of that. What we're trying to do, and this is going to be distributed to law schools and published in law journals, is to show that all of these claims are completely false. I'm going to skip the anti-Semitism and the use of religious themes, which is also part of that, talk a little bit about following the money, and try, when do we go to Q&A? Give me a five-minute warning. Is it now?
You've got about 5 minutes.
Okay. There's a huge amount of money in this. This is not accidental. I talked about them finding a new mission to maintain themselves. We're talking about multi-million dollar organizations, very well placed. And one of the problems, now that not only the Israeli government, the Jewish community has woken up to that there's a threat out there, but I think in most cases they don't understand how deeply entrenched and how powerful this money makes them. European governments, largely in secret, provide what we estimate as 100 million euros a year to about 80 different organizations whose daily work is to use the language of war crimes and apartheid and discrimination against Israel in this process. 40 of them are based in Israel, roughly 30 to 40 are Palestinian. There are a few European groups. That's a huge amount of money. I'm not talking about the stuff that I showed you earlier in Human Rights Watch and Amnesty. This is just from European governments. It's a huge industry. And again, I could take you through dozens of examples of this, and this is what makes NGO Monitor different than the other organizations. We track, we're a research organization. We go and we look for the details. Details, the devil is in the details. Electronic Intifada, I mentioned earlier, Ali Abu Nima, is one of the main speakers at all these Israel apartheid and BDS activities. Who pays a salary? We were wondering. Not just the salary. He's got a huge travel budget. He travels well. And he's got a big staff. And we looked at his 990 form, and it had a small amount. It didn't make any sense. Part of it is incorporated in the United States. But we had some information that he got money from Europe. And it turns out that within the Dutch government, in one of those humanitarian aid organizations, which has a budget of 124 million euros a year, buried in there are three or four different aspects of funding for Electronic Intifada, including his travel and his staff and other things like that. This is an organization that calls Peace Now a right-wing Zionist racist group, and it's funded by the Dutch government. Yeah, exactly. Now, that doesn't mean that the Dutch prime minister and foreign minister say this is good, but what's happened is over the last 15 years, these groups have taken advantage of, European naivete and European bureaucracy and put themselves in these positions, plus European sympathy for the Palestinian cause. And that's where the money, all of those things together. And there are dozens of examples like that. We now have the Dutch government. I met with the Foreign Affairs Committee members last week, 2 weeks ago. I talked to the Dutch foreign minister. He's been interviewed in the paper. It's an issue. And we're hoping that the funding is going to be cut off. When you look at all the different parts of where the money comes from, to me, I'm not going to convince many of these ideologues that Israel's a wonderful place and you shouldn't be accusing Israel of war crimes. They're not going to be convinced of that. What I might be able to do, and I'm not thinking about it on a personal basis, but what NGO Monitor's purpose is, working with a lot of other organizations. We're 14 people. We have 5 or 6 people on the research staff. We have one person doing communications and marketing. So we talk to ADL. We talk to AJC. We talk to World Jewish Congress. We talk to just about every organization. Help us put Hillel and the Israel on Campus Coalition. I won't leave anybody out, but they're all out there. Run with our material. We do the research. We do it well. And if we can embarrass, if we can name and shame enough people, if we can force changes in the funding, it's closing off the tap. And we've had some successes in that. The largest, most, I think, important success is the first one, the Ford Foundation. 6 years ago, something like that, I spent most of my talking time talking about the Ford Foundation. They funded most of the NGOs that went to Durban in 2001. They funded zero in what was called the Durban 2 conference in 2009, and we expect that they will not fund any also in the Durban 3 that's supposed to happen in September 2011. The Irish government, not because of our work, but because of a recession, cut off the funding. The Canadian government cut off $10 million. That's a lot of money. That's $10 million less than they had before, and these NGOs are suing the Canadian government, and not successfully so far. That's right, you gave us money before. That's the lawsuit is you gave us money before, we demand to have it again. And they get a lot of support from the media. These are liberal, humanitarian, human rights groups. The Dutch government, I said, is investigating. I have to say something that we haven't published yet. The British government cut off funding for 5 of the worst organizations, I'm happy to say. That was a big change. They tend to go, but this was, it took quite a bit of pressure. And the new Israel Fund has new guidelines. We're waiting to see if they actually implement those guidelines, but if they do, and I think there's a 50-50 chance that there's enough pressure on them to do that, that will also mean a significant change in the way that this whole funding process goes, because European governments will often say to us, well, you tell us that these organizations engage in demonization, delegitimization, anti-Semitism, but the New Israel Fund funds them, and that's like a rabbi giving a kosher seal of approval, a hechsher. If that stops, then the European governments will no longer be able to use that as an excuse, and I think, well, actually, there are people in Europe who realize that at best or at worst, they're just throwing their money out the window. If you don't care about Israel, most Europeans don't, I have to say, but you do care about throwing money out, especially now. So these kinds of issues are definitely on the table. We've also been able to show that the fact that all this goes through in secret has had very important ramifications for Israel. And just like the United States has a Foreign Agents Registration Act, which I believe is now being used on the issue of a big lobbying organization, including involvement, I believe, with Libya, Israel has now passed a similar law. If you get money from a foreign government and you're involved in politics, you got to tell people, because it's a conflict of interest.
When was that done?
About 3 weeks ago, and that was, we were very much involved in giving the information for that. I think, and I'm getting close to the end here, so I just want to say the long-term strategy, go back to where I started, is to recapture the moral framework of human rights. Not too far from here, there's a gentleman named Robert Bernstein who founded Human Rights Watch. I told you about him at the beginning, and he's now established an organization called Advancing Human Rights. And the basic principle there is to recapture what Human Rights Watch was supposed to be, and was undermined and hijacked, and to recapture those moral frameworks. I'm always accused, or often accused, of wanting to have immunity for Israel, which of course is nonsense. No country is perfect. The goal is to end the double standards. The goal is to end the cynical abuse of human rights language as a political weapon. And to do that, we have to restore the moral and universal framework of human rights. Everybody should be judged by the same standards. There are no free passes for Hamas or for Libya or for any other country. And judge us by the same standards, and then there's no complaints. It's going to take a huge effort because it's so deeply ingrained, as I explained. Following the money is an important part of that, naming and shaming, and also developing alliances, the people who are squeezed out of the process. When I go to a human rights meeting or to a Durban 2 or 3 conference, among the people who are there complaining of the fact that people who really are suffering from racism and from discrimination, particularly issues like women in the Arab world, they're never discussed. Those are taboo. They're squeezed out because Israel is the flavor of the week, the month, and the decade. Those are serious issues. We've had some success in exposing some of the dirty secrets, Human Rights Watch and elsewhere, and that led Bob Bernstein to realize that the organization had been hijacked from underneath him. When they went to Saudi Arabia, when they hired a Nazi memorabilia collector to be the expert on Israel, when they appointed last month an activist in the Palestinian Front, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the PFLP, a terrorist organization, Sharon Jabarin, was appointed to the Human Rights Watch board about a month ago. And I think that at some point, a lot of the people involved are going to increasingly follow Bob Bernstein's lead in saying this is no longer an acceptable process. This is no longer something we can turn our heads to. We were able to convince even the United Nations not to have another NGO forum at Durban 2 in Geneva in 2009. We are working with all the other organizations. I don't want to overdo what one organization does, but this is our niche. This is how we fit into the puzzle. Cameron and Honest Reporting do media, and UN Watch does the UN specifically, and there are other organizations in memory does tremendous work in Palestinian Media Watch in terms of different aspects of the media. The NGO world is very much part of that process, and when the NGOs are the primary leaders, we've got to be up there and we've got to be able to stop them from getting in. And I think that Naomi Klein's condemnation of me and Anne Baevsky for being the generals of the six-day Durban war is maybe exaggerated, but very much, I think, I wear that as a badge of pride, that we were able to prevent the NGOs from recreating Durban 1 in Geneva, and we'll do the same thing in New York. What you have in front of you, the boycotts, divestment, and sanctions, the sewer system, which we handed out by the thousands at universities, and we've got hundreds, over 1,000 different responses and requests for copies and things like that. I have to admit, this is the naming and shaming part of what we do. I'm an academic. I'm tending to be pretty dry. I didn't think this was going to have an impact. I was kind of nervous about this. But the people who work with us in NGO Monitor convinced me that we need to really, you got to get down and dirty with these organizations because they do that to us. And you got to use satire and ridicule. And this has had we've gotten a tremendous amount of good feedback, particularly from Jewish students on campuses as a means of naming and shaming the organizations involved in this process. So it has shown that this process is extremely important. And what I would like to do is simply encourage all of you to use our material, to refer to it when necessary, to send us emails if there are organizations you need more information on. And thank you very much for listening.
Thank you, Gerald. Right, stay right here, don't go away. Thank you very much, Gerald, for such a wonderful set of remarks, and we appreciate all of the background. My name is Erwin Hochberg. I'm chairman of the board of the Middle East Forum, and indeed I've met most of you, and thank you all for being here. We have some time available for Q&A, and I know you're all itchy about asking questions, so let's do this. Let's just announce your name. I'll try to recognize you. It's a difficult room, so speak up. Try not to make statements. Try to ask a question as briefly as possible. Announce your name and speak as distinctly as possible, and we'll go along as quickly as we can. Over in the back.
Hi.
Your name?
Yeah. Hi, I'm Larry Angelo. I'm a psychiatrist now. I'm at Columbia University. I teach in the medical school at Columbia University. This year, the American Psychiatric Association annual meeting, presidented currently by, just incidentally, by a Jewish woman, invited Desmond Tutu to be, are you familiar with this issue? Invited Desmond Tutu to be the convocation speak. 24 psychiatrists wrote an angry letter asking that he not be allowed, that he be boycotted because he's a boycotter, resigned. These were fellows. These were very senior psychiatric fellows of the organization. 24 resigned. The other 7,000 haven't. And I suspect that it's going to be really, really difficult to communicate to a group of well-intentioned 7 to 10,000 psychiatrists meeting why Desmond Tutu, talk about halos, is not a good guy. Like, what help can we get from you guys?
The halo is so strong on some of these cases that it's not going to, you're not going to, you got, how many did you get? 24 out of 7,000. Well, 24 is a good, it's a good start. And I can tell you, all I can say is that you can continue to, it is a war of attrition. Being able to raise these issues in an articulate manner is important. Desmond Tutu specifically, because we focus on NGOs, organizations, not so much individuals, we don't, unless the person is a head of a major NGO, he's part of that elders group, actually, so we have material on that. And Jimmy Carter, exactly. And Jimmy Carter is part of that elders, he may be the head of that elders group. And so the answer is, as I was going to tell you, there's not much we can help you with, but the answer is we do have, including who their allies are, and how they also, in the process, have made alliances actually with J Street. Their PR people are the same. And you can see the political nature of this process. Now, I don't know how that's going to play out to a group of psychologists. Psychiatrists. I knew I was going to get into trouble there. But there's a broader issue as well, and that's something that we've just started off. It took us a while to raise some funding for this. But we have done a series of reports about the way that the expertise is, that the claimed expertise is used in different frameworks. The Lawfare was one big project that we did. How legal language and legal claims are manipulated, and people who are, even people who are in the legal field, particularly people who aren't in the legal field, are fooled to think there's substance. We have just started a project which we call medical malpractice, which is, it's not just the psychiatrist. This is almost every major gathering around the world. There was a major public health field, and I got a number of requests because they had speakers on the list who write in the journals who are basically propagandists. And they are usually affiliated with groups like Physicians for Human Rights Israel and other organizations who very much use walk the walk, talk the talk, but in fact there's no substance there. I'll just tell you a quick story because I have to do this. It's not relevant, but it is. A few years ago, the Diabetes Monthly, which has a huge circulation around the world, had at the hundreds of thousands of people, had a front page story, Israel is responsible for diabetes in Gaza. Complete, absolute nonsense, but it was a front page story. And it was written by somebody who was part of Doctors Without Borders, Medicine Sans Frontier. And this was so absurd that we went to the heads of Medicine Sans Frontier. We opened Simon Wiesenthal Foundation. Somebody else wrote a series of letters. We had meetings with them. The person was fired, and we have not had a similar incident either related to diabetes or related to the Medicine Sans Frontier since then. So being able to act in that way, using that example, and I can send it to you, may also show how this whole framework, there's no reason for a group of psychiatrists or any other medical group to be involved in this kind of partisan politics.
Thank you. Anyone on this side? Nina? Anyone else?
Right across from me.
Joe, just before you chime in. And isn't part of the problem that so many people in Israel support these groups that really run counter to Israel's best interests?
You know, they're not.
Yeah. Or someone like Danny Danone tries to put forth something to fight this against them. There's a lot of opposition, it seems.
There are different kinds of opposition, but I would say the hardcore opposition is not so many people. But they are so well financed. They have such immediate access, first of all, because whatever they say gets into Haaretz. And when it gets into Haaretz, it's read by the journalists and the diplomats and everybody else. So you have a huge multiplying factor there. Maybe there are 100 or a couple of hundred influential Israelis who are that far on the, I guess, the left of the political spectrum that they become easily used for and use themselves, push themselves this agenda. But we're a democracy, and I always use this response. Israelis vote, and that's where the majority of Israelis vote. These people are not spokesmen for anybody but themselves. And I think that point needs to be made. We're not going to shut people up because it's impossible to do that. What we can do is ridicule them and try to cut off the funding, which is what we've been doing. And I always make the point when I meet with the diplomats and others, and that's, I think, had an impact on some of the British officials that I've been meeting. That you, if you want to manipulate a democracy, you're really challenging the whole basis, the whole philosophical basis of democratic society. So if you're going to give money to Israeli political organizations to change Israeli policy, you might as well just trash all of democracy. And I think that's one of the reasons they pulled back a bit on this.
Richard?
Richard Allen. First, I want to thank Professor Steinberg because some of you may know we have an organization that we just formed called JCC Watch. Because the JCC in Manhattan is partnering with and linking with groups that support BDS. And really, we stand on the we're midgets standing on your shoulders because we're relying in total on what the work that you and your organization is doing. And so I'm just encouraging everybody here that if there's any way to support Professor Steinberg, because the work he's doing is just instrumental, even in the battle that we have in New York. And by the way, we're meeting at Crame 11. There's an attorney here named Peter Kolbazan, who I met with Rabbi Joy Levitt at the JCC, and who told me it's okay to be, it's totally okay, and one can have the view of being for the boycott and for Israel. And this is the type of thinking that is going on in our Jewish organizations. And as an example, and I've spoken to Erwin Huckberg, who was the head of UJA Federation here in New York. The UJA Federation has given over $300,000 to Jewish funders for social justice. And this is one of those worst groups. And I guess in a way, my question for everybody, and I know there's no immediate answer, is why are our Jewish organizations funding such outrageous anti-Israel political organizations, and yet people still continue to not raise their voice and not say there's a problem here?
What was the name of the organization?
It was Jewish Funders for Social Justice, and they gave $300,000 to them. It's on their 990 form. You can get it if you want a copy. I'll let send it to you.
They gave it to whom?
It's Jewish Funders for Social Justice.
Oh, that's the federation.
I believe it's 2000. Well, you know, as you know, the tax returns are not filed until way later. So it's the last tax return. I believe it's 2008. If I could send you a copy of it.
But you didn't ask. You sort of asked me a question. I want to actually give you an answer.
Okay.
I'm not going to talk about New York because I don't know enough about the details. Obviously, you do more than I do. I want to tell you a quick story about Orange County. Orange County, there was something called the Olive Tree Initiative, which was funded in part or had some relationship. It's always very murky when the fights go on. They say, well, we put them on our website, but we didn't really give them money, but somebody gave us money. I'm not going to get into that. My point was that the people in Orange County Federation thought they were doing good things. They had no clue as to where the money was going. They had no clue about the organizations that were involved. Yes, you get a few people who manipulate the system, who can get in and say there's nothing, and then justify by saying there's no contradiction between boycotting, which means the Durban framework and the elimination of Israel, and being a supporter of Israel. But most of the people involved don't even think that they have to do the homework, and that's where we come in. And that's actually, I'm not saying I don't want to use that flowed through what you did, but in the sense of knowing that you have to look and see. And I think that's something that I hope the JCC might have learned from this. You have to look and see who you're partnering with,
not yet.
Who you're advertising with. The Orange County Federation pulled back. And it was not a left and right issue. It's sort of an embarrassment for them, without them saying it, that we allowed ourselves to be used, to be exploited by these people with a political agenda, a very radical political agenda. And that message is slowly getting across as we do more and more of this kind of research.
Professor Simon, just as a quick clarification, very quick. The Jewish Funders for Social Justice, what they did, those were the rabbis that wrote the letter in the Wall Street Journal against Glenn Beck. And my point is, I'm not associating them with BDS. What I'm saying is that the Jewish organizations, just to clarify, because I realize that someone might get the wrong impression that's aligned with BDS, but my point is that Jewish, the Federation, is funding political organizations. And I guess, you know, the whole feeling, whether it's the JCC fund partnering with and linking with BDS organizations or the Federation giving money to the JCC so they can partner with, and it just keeps on going.
All right, let's go on because we want to get some more questions. I just want to make one other point in connection with this. It doesn't always require funding. Frequently what happens is, in a naive way, you can partner with organizations without giving money, not realizing what the nature of the organization is that you are partnering with. Bear that in mind. You had a question here.
How does one make a U.S. tax deductible contribution to NGO money?
Dove, where are you here? There he is. Okay. You can ask Dove, but I'll tell you anyway. Dove is our CEO. Jerry Lazarus has joined us as responsible for our funding apparatus. And we have a 501c3 called American Friends of NGO Monitor. Is it on the handouts? No. Okay. Next time we're going to do that. American Friends of NGO Monitor. And so we should have a clicker for that part, too.
Are you well funded, or do you need something?
I was just going to say we are. Yeah, right. Please. Let me just say, we are 14 people, which is a small office, and we have been compared with AIPAC. When people don't like us, then we get immediately boosted up, which is good. We're happy with that. They are underpaid. Everybody's underpaid. There's a lot of hard work that goes into it, and I will say that our budget has, unfortunately, because like other organizations, we've had a couple of hits from donors who have not renewed funding, so we're definitely, any assistance would be very much appreciated. I didn't come here to fundraise, but it's part of the process.
But don't forget your guests of the Middle East.
I also know that, so I'm careful.
Any other questions? Here, please.
What is our address here?
We're in Philadelphia.
The website has a link. So I think that's...
Question.
I thought we were in New York.
Okay.
Do the NGOs have coordination with each other, and is there somebody behind the overall attack that these NGOs are making?
There's a lot of coordination. I'm hesitant to talk about a grand plan, although George Soros' name comes up a lot. It's not that specifically top down. But clearly there is a division of labor. They very frequently meet and decide who's going to take which part of the attack. And very often you'll see, for instance, in the United Nations, there are clear assaults that take place from the same 15 or 20 organizations from different angles, almost always repeating the same pattern. So there is a great deal of coordination. You can see this, and you can even physically going to a meeting in Geneva and seeing where people are sitting and how clustered they are. And you can see, I'll give you one. I was invited for the first time. The European Parliament had a hearing on this issue of funding for NGOs that was originally proposed by the Israeli and Palestinian NGOs. And they came in as a group with an entourage. And I came in by myself, and I was immediately, they have an NGO section, and they said, you have to sit with the Israeli delegation. And I said, but I'm an NGO. And they said, yes, but you're on the wrong side. It was something very bizarre and confusing. But it tells you, you could see that they came in together. It's not just a conspiracy theory. These groups have been working a great deal.
Their boards are,
and the individuals, you'll see people like Michael Sfard, and you'll see Dror Etkes move from place to place, almost doing the same thing. And frankly, people, Jeremy Ben-Ami, as close to a coordinator as there is, both in terms of the New Israel Fund and what's called Ben Or Consulting in Israel, and now, of course, all the variations of J Street, they're essentially the same. Not a conspiracy, but very,
inbred.
And very clever management of repackaging the same thing. And that's why it seems like there's so many Israelis out there, because they're really the same group of people reinventing themselves. And then with all that money, I have to say, one of the things that I find particularly disturbing is that with all that money, there must be 200 different forms of internships and graduate programs that basically should just have the name NIFJ Street on them and Human Rights Watch. It's the same people. Kathleen Paredes is on all of those boards, for instance, and funnels money into them. So it's a huge multiplier effect.
Could you give on your site, on your website, the list of who these people are and how they serve across the board?
We do, and I'll highlight that. If you look under the J Street of Jeremy Ben-Ami, it's all that in detail.
It would be good to see
a structure.
A structure that shows.
I don't know if we have that. Okay.
One final question.
To assist.
Nina?
That's another $100,000. More than about NGOs. I mean, a lot of the Europeans and so on, oh, we're not anti-Semitic, it's just anti-Zionist. I don't believe them. Should one let the fiction of the anti-Zionism continue, or should one say, no, this is anti-Semitism? How do you play that?
I play it straight, and when it's very clearly anti-Semitism, I think we need to say that. I think it does have an impact. It's if you could, these images of Christmas cards, and there are dozens of such things, or statements that talk about the crucifixion of the Palestinians, when they use specific theological anti-Semitic images and language, then that is too overwhelming to be ignored, and it does create friction. It creates internal dissonance. Psychiatrists are very good at need this for this.
Yeah.
That when they say we're not anti-Semitic, we love Jews, we just don't like Israel, and then you confront them with this evidence, which is repeatedly stated, and Anthony Julius has really documented this quite well, then it's much harder for them to sustain that argument. So I would be careful about using the term anti-Semitism when it's not as blatant, but when it's blatant, hit them right over the head with it.
Thank you.
On that happy note.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.